Hoot. 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 Hoot.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another fucking edition of the hashtag worst podcast in the world. That's right. Crack a beer, take off your pants, and get ready for Talking Shop. That's pretty good, right, Emilio? What do you think?
Yeah, I thought that was excellent, actually. Yeah, it was good.
Should I work on that a little bit? Shut up, Doug.
Maybe I would, but it's okay. You have to add that Jesus Christ, like, you know, that guttural machine gun intro.
Right, right. Well, we lost the machine gun. He is not with us this week, and we lost the big man. The big LG is not with us this week, but we have a super, super special guest, a guy who has been a friend of mine for 20 years, 20 plus years, really, really long time. I met him when he was like 16 years old, maybe. And maybe he's going to correct me on that because he has a much better memory than I do. But we are with the first ever WWE lightweight champion. It's Theodore Perkins, TJP. He's in the house. There it is. Boom.
Okay. One, this is memory aside. Your intro, you're not considering the people who already aren't wearing pants. Do they put them on then take them off?
You drop it on the weekend. I for sure there's a lot of people listening to this podcast not wearing pants.
You're being pantsist when you say that. So be careful.
Maybe they take off their underwear.
Hey,
they go further.
As long as you're alone and whatever you do in your apartment or home, and that's up to you, buddy. You know, so
you're assuming they're all just freeballing it.
Have you ever seen a Talking Shop fan, T?
Yeah, a Talking Shop fan.
By the way, when you hit the part about worst podcast ever, I told Aria I was doing this today, and she was like, "Oh, awesome, my favorite podcast." And then I was like, "I said it was just us three," and she goes, "Oh, just you three? I'm not listening."
You and about probably we just lost about 45% of our audience as well, you know, because the Good Brothers aren't here. Maybe more. We'll make a comeback at some point. But yeah, TJP. So I said lightweight champion, WWE lightweight. I should have said WWF lightweight champion. And there was a reason. It's because I always tell Taka Michinoku when he was working for New Japan, I used to say, "Oh, Taka Michinoku, whoa. First ever cruiserweight, WWE cruiserweight champion." He goes, "No, fuck you. WWF lightweight champion." So I just figured I'd just twist them on you, you know?
It was him, Aguila, and Christian, but Christian counted for 1.5.
I know it was like Super Loco. Devin Storm was another one.
Oh, you're right. I remember Super Loco. Was that now just Super Crazy, right?
Now it's just Super Crazy.
Dude, Tiger Mask did a Super Astros. It's
Tiger Mask 4. My arch nemesis. How dare you bring up his name on this show? It was like all those ECWA Super 8 guys who kind of like basically were like the end. That was like the independent world. You're flipping through like PWI magazine. This is like just the early days of the internet. And you would see guys like Reckless Youth and Devin Storm and all the names that nobody knows who the hell we're talking about at this point.
Reckless Youth was the fucking man, dude. Everybody wanted to be Reckless Youth. I was telling a story just last night. I was doing this indie show in Dallas, but it was all young kids, you know, and they're like, I had to give them the old back in my day fucking speech at TGI Fridays where I chewed on my $2 steak or whatever the hell. But I was telling them that like when we were first starting, it was like at a time when like the internet was like primitive. Like there was like WWF.com and like that's it.
It was like they had the AOL chats.
Yeah. So like if you didn't go into like a chat room and get lucky with like more than just a couple people in there, other than that, like the writers mailed their packets to you, like actual mail on paper.
Oh, that's so wild.
Yeah, like so that was like the time that we started, and I was telling them like when like
that's why Meltzer Rev has all Pro, those stacks of fucking papers. They're all the
he's still mailing them out.
Is he really?
he still people, owes people
that yeah, some people hit him up and they're like, hey,
he had a shitload of subscribers maybe in 1997. And he's like he's still back like
back.
He probably thinks he's probably so happy the digital world came about because he's like, I still gotta mail this shit out.
That's fucking insane.
No, but I was telling them like you know, Reckless Youth and all these different guys, like I was telling them like when we were starting out, like the first indies we would do, like it was all regional. like nobody outside of the area ever went. But then like, you know, like Millennium Pro or like some of those places like in like 99, 2000 were like kind of like bringing in one guy at a time. Like they would bring in like Low Key to wrestle Super Dragon or like Amazing Red or something, but we would just only hear of these guys. So we didn't know if Amazing Red was like 6'3" and built like a fucking linebacker. Yeah, we had no idea what anybody looked like. There's no way. Yeah. There's no way to look this dude's up. There was no YouTube or social media. We just heard like, unless you knew somebody from like New York
or you got a tape and somebody traded you a tape.
And literally a VHS tape. Cause like DVD was like a new format. They weren't really making it.
You know, the thing that changed, Emilio, the thing that changed, I think, wrestling. So let's go back a little bit more before we get into this, because literally TJ is going to eat a pizza while he's on this fucking podcast. And that's our new part of our system here is we want our guests to eat a meal while we talk to them.
Welcome to Talking Mukbang with TJP.
Exactly. This is like a David Portnoy type of thing. But hey, anyway, so me and TJP, we go back so far. So I started in like 97, I started training. I think I debuted in 97 or 98. I can't even remember at this point, but
in a class of 96, I think I started training
bumps. Yeah. Training.
And then you were working by 97. Cause I started training at Jesse's and his like Saturday morning things when it was him and Bill, like 98, when I was at the end of 98. Cause I remember time stamping 15? It. 13. So I time stamped it with 13? High school. Yeah. Freshman year, you know, when you can do summer school, like before your freshman year starts, like do some, like get some stuff out of the way or pre-do some classes. So I went in anyway. Remember at the time, like this is the world was a little primitive.
How did you find the school Hard Knocks? Did you just find it on the web?
Yes. Well, so I was always like, my dad had me like as an all sport athlete growing up. But when I went to high school, I was like, I want to be a pro wrestler. I'm going to wrestle amateur and then it'll somehow get me wrestling. But the office was like, we don't have an amateur team. So I said, fuck, well, there goes my plan. Like this was my key to greatness. And now you're telling me I can't do it. But in my summer school classes, there was a kid in one of my classes that had Jesse's school shirt on. School and I was like,
EWF.
Yeah, dude, I was sending fucking snail mail to like all these places that have ads in PWI, like Dean Malenko School in Tampa or like Larry Sharp or whoever, like these different guys. I think I even sent one to Sean because Sean had advertised the school was coming up. So like if I was a little older, I would have been in Spanky and Brian's class and if I would have waited a year or so. But like this kid had this shirt and I was like, what is that? Like, I didn't know what indie wrestling was. And he was like, yeah, it was a school like nearby. And so I started going to the Saturday morning classes. So actually, Emilio, I met this fool like two or three times for the first, in his mind, it's the first time. But like, I had to meet this guy like a few times because it was like, oh, hey, nice to meet you. Yeah,
I'm a fucking fuck big off. Shot.
Yeah, but yeah. This big timer who had like debuted a year and a half ago was like, what, like skyrocketing to success.
Was I still a Mono Negro at that time or was I Los Cubitos?
You guys had just started doing like Cubanitos.
Okay, Rock, so you have to explain what that gimmick was, because I don't think a lot of people know that you were in a hood wrestling.
When I started, I was like maybe like 15 or whatever, 14. So I was a little like really skinny little kid. And there was another kid that was around my age. His name was Sonny. And he wrestled as like El Payasito Dinko, which was just like a Mexican take on Dink, like the, you know, so they were like, oh, well, you know what? They're so young. They're so small. Why don't we like make a minis division and they'll be our like minis instead of, and this is also their way of like, you know, where we came from was like, you know, very fucking carny as fuck. So like, instead of like getting the real minis who were just probably like an hour away or 2 hours away in like Mexico or San Diego or something, like they just said, oh shit, like why don't we just make these two kids our mini division, just let them go out there wrestle. So they gave me a hood, they gave me a mask gimmick called El Mono Negro, which means pretty much like the black monkey. I had like this mask with like fur on the top and like little ears. And like all black suit, like, you know, arms covered, legs covered with like fake hair on the, it was like very inspired by like Foligno, but it wasn't as good as Foligno. So like,
are you sure it wasn't inspired by the fact that you had a full like facial hair beard at 14
as well? Probably.
Yeah. Like this dude was,
wait,
he looked like this at 13, 14 years old. Like,
have you never seen my picture with Be Real that I put up on Instagram?
No.
Yeah, there's a picture of me with Be Real from Cypress Hill, and I was probably like 14. I had like straight up like goatee and shit like already.
So you were already a grown man. He was just a full wrestling grown man. Yeah. So T, did you look like you were six then? If he was like a grown man,
I looked like a 10-year-old.
On Twitter or Instagram or something, like a week ago, I posted a picture of my first match. I had like this. Remember Fresh Peaches? That swimsuit place nearby.
That's the one.
Everybody would like get their gear, but they just did custom swimsuits, and they didn't understand why wrestlers were hitting them up for custom spandex.
Right.
So they made this awful looking Filipino stuff that was way too baggy, and like
I remember that.
I didn't. My first couple matches weren't even with like Bill and Jess. Just some of the.
It was like indie dudes, stuff, right? Some
of the guys like Rage and Cody West and those type of dudes would like hear about lucha shows and go try to pick up matches. So I would, I'm just like, hey, I want to wrestle. And they're like, yeah, maybe you can get in and on a match. So I get put in like, I did like a handful of them. It wasn't like I was wrestling all the time, but like, yeah, when I was 13, I looked like I was 10. And so they gave me a mask from the merch table. So I was wearing somebody else's mask, and not like it was like a famous dude. Superman, so like all Yanko, the,
right.
Not yet. That was the second one. Okay. Bill gave me that one. I got that on the wall. Actually.
Yeah. That's there. That mask in the middle.
I have Sonny's up there too.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I don't remember the guy's name. It almost looks like fish gills, but yeah, I posted a picture of it. It looks so stupid. Like I'm standing in the corner holding the rope like that. Like I don't even put my elbow on the ropes. I'm holding the ropes like this. Like,
so
it was
like
so
you,
bad.
When you first start wrestling, you don't know what, like, I mean, I feel like if you're, I wasn't privy to it, but like, yeah, you do a lot of like weird stuff where like, you don't look, you know, you don't learn later that you're always you're always trying to pose and look strong, you know, like
you can't just be like you get in the corner,
kind of like just holding the rope. Like, even though it might be comfortable for you, it doesn't look, you don't look strong. Like what you're supposed to look, you know?
Yeah. You look like a pansy, man. It's terrible. Yeah. Like I, you know, you get on the ring with like one knee and kind of go between the middle and bottom, like you crawl in and shit. Right, so that was the type of shit I would do, but they're like, well, you can do some of the high spots, we'll just beat your ass the rest of it. It's okay. Right.
Yeah, it didn't really matter because like everybody, we were so small like back in the day that everybody would just beat our asses and do all like all their cool like power moves to us. So it wouldn't really matter.
Well, we also came from a school that like that it's weird because like for years I thought, man, my school didn't teach us how to work. But then later I was like, they kind of taught us how to work. They just didn't teach us that like they just didn't teach us what they taught. Like, so we learned how to do some shit. And then they kind of figured that we would put the puzzle together.
Yeah,
and then later. So then for years, I was like, you didn't teach us how to work. I had to learn this shit from somewhere else. And then later in life, I was like, actually, no, you taught us. Okay. You just didn't fucking finish the lesson. Like, we would know how to do little shit, but yeah.
That's what I kind of liked about it. Cause it was kind of old school and that it was like open-ended, like in the fact of like, go figure it out yourself. We're going to give you enough tools.
You had to read the room.
Yeah. And then it's up to you.
You had to learn to read the room.
Yeah. I mean, because I think that's a better way of learning than just like, than just taking somebody's hand and like going, hey, go ahead. You got to learn this, you know, like the whole way through, you know,
I'd rather it's less processed, you know?
Yeah. You got to learn to use your instincts and, you know, in each of your experiences. Yeah.
But yeah, we were the polar opposites starting young. He was like a 30-year-old man. And I looked half of my age and I was already like 13.
Yeah.
And he big timed you the first time you met him.
Well,
somebody younger than me, finally. I couldn't wait to haze him.
Oh, okay. So yeah, that was the one thing. I thought his partner Reyes.
I was the youngest.
I thought his partner. Yeah, I thought his partner Reyes was the big hazer until I was around him more, and I was like, this guy's beating my ass more than Reyes is. Reyes just talks. He just likes to look tough.
So remember when I said, like, oh, all these guys doing all their power moves? There was finally somebody younger and smaller than me that I could do all these power moves that I've been dying to do. So, like, I could finally do a power bomb. I could finally do, like, all the cool shit. Pearl River Plunge.
That is so fucked up.
I remember the first time when there was a practice with all the older brothers together, and I was there because I met them. I would see them come and go, but not everybody all at once. And when I was younger, I was way different than now. Like, the two consensuses on me now, I'm either an asshole or kind of like a laid back clown, but like outgoing. But at the time, I was so shy. I didn't talk to anybody. Like, people didn't know I existed for years in, like, the school. Like, I came and went, and people kind of just didn't know. Like, but, yeah, I remember, like I was like, yeah, the older brothers kind of lean on me a little bit, but I can wrestle and pick. I picked up stuff pretty fast. But I'm the first time I practiced with this fool, I remember getting in the ring with him and, like, just trying to do a move back, and he just fucking like threw me on the floor and was like, you're not doing moves, what are you talking about? Like, and I was like, oh shit. It's like in cable guy when they're at Medieval Times, and he tells them, you better get on the horse pal. I don't think he's kidding. Like, that's what it was like. I was like, shit, like, is this where the business gets real?
When you started training, was like Daniels around, like Chris Danielson, was he still around at that time too? A little bit.
Yeah, I think he was still around a little bit, because then I remember it was a big like thing, him going to Michinoku and stuff. He had like this aura about him, you know, Mikey Henderson, Bobby Bradley, Haystacks, all those guys.
For me, like, Chris was a big deal, because like whenever I go to his class, it was always like so serious. I fucking hated him. Like, probably for the first like 2 months that I knew him, like, hated him a lot, like, badly, because like, you would get in there and he was like so like regimented and like how he was doing stuff, and like, he was really good, right? And he knew he was really good, and he didn't have time to waste on, like, you know, when you go to wrestling school, there's a, you know, some of the guys that take it really seriously, and then there's a bunch of guys who are just kind of like in there, just kind of just doing it, kind of basically helping to support the system for the guys who are really want to take it seriously and maybe try to go to the next level, you know. And then for the other ones, it's like, I don't know, they're just, you know, they just want to try it out basically. And then it doesn't really go past that, but it's like,
I love those dudes, you know, 'cause then they do their first tumbles and like quarters and car keys fall out of their pocket. And it's like, yeah, what did you think?
You're like, dude, put that in a bag, put it on the desk, put it somewhere. Yeah. But Chris, like, I remember, like, and if you messed up like a spot, or you messed up like a drill, like, Chris was such an asshole at that time. And he admits it later, like to me, that what an asshole he was. But he'd be like, what the fuck are you doing? Get the fuck back in line. That fucking was terrible. How do you fuck that up? It's a drop down. And then you'd like, so you'd be like in line, and you'd be like, oh God, I better get it. And then you're like, just like, but like, you had to really pay attention, because it's not a joke either, though.
Yeah, he came from like a strict upbringing of other art. So, you know, like, our best, in my opinion, our best coach ever was probably Kevin.
Kevin was a good coach. Kevin, a guy named Kevin Quinn, who probably a lot of people don't know, but he's basically like, him and Chris Daniels were a tag team down in Puerto Rico. Kevin worked for WWE. He had a WWE contract. He worked like Mexico, a name that you wouldn't really know, but like,
he's a mentor to a lot of people that ended up being, yeah, like Val Venus was a guy that like was around them.
Yeah. In the beginning.
Lita in Mexico.
Mojo, yeah.
You know, so a lot of people, it's like an insider thing. Like, there's a kind of a secret society of Kevin people in the business, you know, CM Punk, like, a lot of guys are Kevin guys. But Kevin as a coach was laid back, but he was pretty hard too, in a way. And so I could see with him and Chris, and Chris's upright, like, bringing, like, that strikes me as normal. I would expect that he would be that way.
All right, well, let's fucking fast forward a little bit. So, like, we talked about training in the early days and shit, but things really started to get crazy when we went to Mexico for the first time. And It was you and I, of course, and a guy named Bobby Quants.
You may know him as Rocco Quants in some circles. Yeah.
Do you want to tell that story or should I?
I'd love to tell it just because, like, Bobby was kind of like a hero to me in real life because, like, he was such a free, he's like a real life Forrest Gump. Like, he's the type of guy, like, there's a lot of things he wanted and did do with his life that did not go together. And he was like, not long for any one thing. Like, he would do something, be great at it, and move the fuck on to something else.
Like, just ace the fuck out of it. Like, whatever he was doing.
Yeah. He was just a savant for anything, which was hilarious because, like, he would do all this, but I mean, zero charisma. Like, he looked bored doing this stuff. And we're like, how are you the greatest? Because
he probably was.
Yeah, I was like, how are you the greatest in the world at anything you do? And you're not enthused about it. But so Bobby was such a free spirit. And Bobby wasn't originally supposed to go with us. Originally, it was supposed to be Rocky's partner, Reyes. But Reyes broke his arm in an MMA fight. So he couldn't go to Mexico with us. He basically missed a year of his career, kind of derailed. Like, every, he had to kind of take a detour. What probably his like, the arc of his career changed totally from that.
Right. Trajectory.
Yeah. So Bobby ended up filling in, which he basically used as a retirement tour because he was going to the military right after. And when we were doing media interviews upon arriving, Bobby would always have this different real life gimmick he was trying to play in every one.
We also, Amelia, we had no idea what we were getting into. All we knew was, like, we had a plane ticket and we were arriving on this date and we were coming back home like 3 months later. Right. And so like, nobody told us anything. They told us to get masks. So we all got like these really, the only thing we were able to put together was like similar tights. Right. I think in the beginning. And these really shitty basic masks, and we all had different colors. Like, I was blue, TJ was red,
Bobby was red. I was yellow.
Oh, you were yellow.
I was yellow. Yeah.
Okay, so you're yellow. Oh yeah, that's right. Then Bobby was red. And I was blue. That's all I remember.
Of course, like, Asian guy. Of course, Asian guy was yellow.
Of course.
And Bobby was the only one with a suitable mask. I remember it was like he had a pretty good one, and we had shitty ones. Our tights at least matched, but they were like, and then they were like, your faces are on our posters already, so there's no reason to put you in a mask. Yeah,
so they told us to get masks, and then, but they had pictures of us and they had already put them on the posters, so I think their idea of us losing the mask would like just
from day one. Yeah. And you know, while we're still on sidetrack, like, we were, you know, it was still old school. And it's probably still old school now. Mexico's such a time warp, and it's like classic in that way. But we were looked as enemies coming in. So we were in the training gym, and people are like, these fucking guys don't know the program. And so we had to kind of earn it pretty hard, you know, for a little while. But we would do these interviews and things and media, and Bobby would always have a new, like, real life angle he was trying to create on the fly just to make himself laugh. So I remember one time he took control. He basically took the interview hostage and said that we were actually a group called the Shrimp Shack Shooters from the That Thing You Do soundtrack, the band. Yeah. And so he said he was Captain Geach and we were the Shrimp Shack Shooters. And then another time they asked him, you know, are you really Cuban? Like, your name is Bobby Quants. He said, actually, my name's Rocco. And they said, oh, okay, your name's Rocco. And he stuck to that lie the whole rest of the trip. And Rocco was the name of this older retired wrestler, like 60s, 70s era wrestler that would come around to the dojo in LA. And we get such a kick out of him because he was so like classic, like NWA Hollywood, like golden years, like wrestler, like drop kick was a huge finish to him and stuff like that.
Yeah. One time, Amelia, he told us, he said, he was talking to like TJ, me and like Danielson or somebody. And he's like, oh, whenever I used to go to Japan, I used to get on the plane, you know, it's about a, you know, 16 hour flight, you know, I would get on the plane. I would think
16 hour flight.
it was so long back then. They probably had to make a stop somewhere too. And he was like, I used to think about these great high spots And I would get there and I'd be like, oh, I couldn't wait to do them. So I would tell the guy I was working with, I came up with this great high spot, tackle, drop down, leapfrog, beautiful drop kick. We were like, wait, what? Like just the first high spot you learned in professional wrestling. That was like what took you 16 hours. But it's like, oh, so old school. That was like, then they probably pinned him and that was like the finish, you know, we're like, okay.
So his name was Mr. Rocco. And so Bobby told everybody he was Rocco. And to this day, if you go back and look at the old tapes of us, dude, in Mexico.
There's some bad fucking interviews from the three of us. Horribly, some of the worst fucking interview, like promos I've ever seen in my life.
Our first one was my favorite. I still have it on. I have it on tape in my case back here.
Yeah, I need that. I need to see the tape. Also, how old were you guys that you went to Mexico for the first time?
TJ wasn't even of legal age. I don't know how he was able to
get into the country. In the general sense,
he's going to try to explain it, but it's definitely illegal.
Okay, look. First of all, our actual first trips to Mexico were years before doing stuff in TJ. So we would do stuff across the border when I was even younger, like I was like 14 or some shit. But this one, which is a real proper excursion to Mexico City, and we're living there and everything. I was 18, but I just turned 18. Mexico for us, and maybe this is my fault, because young boys, you go on an excursion, then you graduate, you become young lions, and et cetera, et cetera. I was the young boy, and I'm pretty sure they just needed to send me somewhere. And they're like, let's just send all of them. And so maybe it's my fault that we went to Mexico, because I got recruited into New Japan. Then I wasn't legal. I was only 17. I was still in high school. But when I turned 18, they sent me on my first tour with these guys. And then shortly after that, we did like a Tokyo Dome show. And then they said, you're going to Mexico. So we ended up in Mexico. But I was 18. I was just not that far into 18.
Right. But even the stuff at 14, how are you getting into a country at 14 years old without a passport?
Well, I think, though, at the time, walking across the border, they weren't how they are now. You didn't used to have a card or a passport. Sometimes they would just say it was the Wild West, like you could go and maybe it was okay. Or sometimes you come back and they'd say, oh, no passport, you're going to jail. Like you didn't know.
Yeah, we never had passports. I think we had licenses, maybe. You were 14, so you probably didn't even have a license.
So let me get this straight. So your parents would say, hey, my 14-year-old son, I'm cool with you going to Mexico and doing God knows
you
what.
Didn't tell them.
Days.
Shit, my parents didn't know shit. I come from a traveling family. My parents worked for the airline, so they were gone a lot. Like they would be gone weeks at a time. But the other end of that coin is that I learned to be self-sufficient at a young age. I could do laundry when I was 10. I could cook basic foods when I was 10, 11 years old, because I was kind of fending for myself. You know, I only had a babysitter and my grandma, and that was it for like weeks at a time. So when I grew up, I never got into trouble. I never drank or did drugs, never put my fingers in light sockets, nothing like that. So when I got older, they never gave me curfews or anything. They're like, he understands not to get in trouble. So when I started wrestling, I just was like, fuck it, I'm just going to do this. And like those stories that we had in the promos in WWE, me and Spanky, and like, I was like, yeah, I would ditch school on a Friday and do like a loop, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, where I go to like San Francisco, Vegas, or San Diego and just jump into different cars and then go back to school on Monday. That was real. Just my parents didn't care. Like, and I just didn't die, thankfully. Like in retrospect, I'm like, this could have been really bad. At the time, you don't realize how perilous that is. But just going across state lines with no money in my pocket,
no ID, like nothing. Like,
yeah, I was riding in the back of cars with dudes that I've only spoken to twice in my life.
Right.
At the time, you think it's okay, but now I look back, I'm like, what the fuck was that?
So this is why Rocky, being the veteran that he was, did he took you under his wing and he was like, come on, kid, you stay with me now. I'll show you the ropes.
We did end up riding together for a lot of shows at a certain point. I remember they had this, I posted a picture of it recently when we were making fun of Rocky's body hair. was that your original thing? Emilio, where that you were something about yes. like shaving?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So that my follow up, I posted a picture of us working. It was at the Legion Hall where that PWG ended up making famous. But that was a wrestling venue in Southern California for a long time before that. And we used to carpool to these shows up there for Freddie Valentine. And he'd have weird death matches and stuff, like him versus Terry Funk in like an alligator chained to the pole match or shit like that.
There'd be like a shoot alligator backstage. And they would be like, don't go past this door because we don't want to disturb the alligator because he'll get like pissed off before they go out there. And then we'd be
He's
like
covered up with a tarp and that was it. Yeah.
We like go in there. We like try to sneak in, of course, and like take a look at this fucking alligator. Like, what is going on? Remember when we met Terry Funk, and Terry was like just walking around back there. He's like, holy shit.
Shit. Remember when we met Abdullah?
Oh God.
Abdullah was a trip.
Yeah. Abdullah was dope.
He was handpicking dudes to cause they needed the locker room to clear out and break up a fight at the end of the night with Abby and Freddie Valentine. And Abby was like, send these two kids out first. Me and Jason Allgood from San Diego. And I was like, oh, fuck, dude. We're the skinniest, like, youngest dudes in this locker room. He's trying to eat us, dude. Like, and so I remember we were waiting behind the curtain. And I looked at Allgood and I was like, never felt like real competition more than this in my life. I looked up and I said, if I get to the ring first, I'm going to anybody but Abdullah. So you're the one that's getting at me. So it was like a real fucking foot race from the curtain to the ring. And of course I beat him. And we caught up later after the show. He and Chuk got stabbed with the fork.
Dude, Emilio, this shit is crazy. So like we had the first match, let's say, of the night. So like it was like TJ and Jason Allgood versus me and Ricky Reyes. And we tore it up. We usually tore it up like for indie wrestling, like in Southern California. So we tore it up, and then we came back and Abby was praising all of us, you know, and Abby's like, I like the way you guys, to me, Reyes, I like the way you guys wrestling. We're doing this angle at the end. I want you guys on my side. I was like, cool. So then,
this fool looked at them and he's like trying to book them for All Japan.
Yeah.
And he looked at me like, you can eat the fork, kid. And I was like, fuck, dude.
He's got the whole room and he's explaining what's going to happen. He's like, me and Freddie Valentine, we're going to go back and forth. We're going to be fighting. I'm going to be on him. We just want, you know, once the Cuban Nitos come out, me and Reyes, then, you know, we're going to start beating up the Freddie Valentine. And then TJ and Jason Allgood are going to hit the ring and then everybody just follow from there. So TJ's like, I remember TJ's on, he's like, I'm going straight to you guys. I'm not going to fucking, I'm not going.
Yeah. I made a beeline for Craze.
Yeah.
Craze was in the old school San Diego guy.
Mentioned the fork. I'm pretty sure he didn't mention the fork. He just said, feed me. Right. Like, so just, which means just come just at go, me, right?
Just get to me. Yeah.
When the guys get in there, poor Jason Allgood was the first one to find out what feed me meant, and that he got a fucking fork straight to the forehead, bro. Shoot.
Cause there's two guys in the ring. Like, we're the first to hit the ring. There's two guys in the ring. There's Abby. And then there's this guy crazy, and he's got a chair. And I looked at Olga, I said, I'm going to the chair, bro. and he goes, and he kind of looked at me. He looked at me like it was a choice, like it was debatable. And I'm like,
no.
So we got in, and I gladly took that shit to the dome, because like 8 minutes later, 10 minutes later, when the brawl, you know, finishes and we meet in the back, this dude's he looks like a blood. Nightmare on Elm Street character. Gushing like blood.
He's not the only one. Abby took the same fork and fucking stabbed like 8 people with it. We were like, I was like, what the, when it was going on in the ring, I'm just like, what the fuck is going on? We're all like, we thought we were getting a huge payday. We were getting like $50, but like some of the other guys were getting probably like $10, $15, maybe no money.
And hepatitis.
And now they have hepatitis, and they're fucking, and they got to go get stitches. Like, I don't know. Like, just in the fucking red, you know, completely, literally. But yeah, there was some cool shit though that happened. Southern California, that's it.
This episode of Talkin' Shop is brought to you by Magic Spoon. Hey, we're all trying to eat better, but healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all that bad stuff. I mean, we're talking 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. That's only 140 calories a serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. You can build your own box or get a variety pack with available flavors like cocoa, fruity frosted, peanut butter, blueberry, and cinnamon. Magic Spoon is bringing back two of those popular flavors, my favorite, cookies and cream and maple waffle, permanently. When these flavors were first introduced for a limited time, they sold out extremely quickly. Go to magicspoon.com/hoots to grab your delicious cereal and try it today. And be sure to use the promo code HOOTS at checkout to save $5 off of your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money with no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/hoots and use the code HOOTS to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode.
So after, you know, TJ makes a beeline to get a chair into the face and Rocky's watching people get hepatitis, when does it happen where you guys are now LA Dojo boys and all of that starts to happen? Because, again, you're still relatively young, and I don't think a lot of people really know how young you guys were really doing this, because now you guys are, like, you know, in your late 30s, and to see what you guys have done now, and just even hearing these stories, is absolutely crazy to me that you guys were so young doing all of this and getting this field experience at a relatively young age. Like, you couldn't even buy booze at a certain point, and you're taking a fucking fork to the face.
Thinking about it now, like in the abstract, if you're so like that guy, Chris, if you're him and you're, I don't know, 28 years old, 30 years old, and you're swinging a chair at the face of a 14-year-old kid and connecting, like
it was still Wild West though. Yeah.
It was crazy. Yeah. You know, I mean, what you were saying about like the age discrepancy and differential, like compared to like experience. And that's not common, I guess, you know, in the business. The path to LA Dojo, like, kind of illustrates that in like probably the wildest way, because a lot of dominoes had to sort of fall a specific way for that. Like, it was really, New Japan fell on our laps by accident, and not even just like one accident. I mean, it's like a handful of accidents in a row that just led us there. Because UPW is really the fulcrum for all of it. So UPW was like one of the original developmental territories before OVW, before Deep South, before FCW. So for anybody who's like a newer wrestling fan, like the last 5-10 years or something, just think like NXT in its most primitive form. That's what UPW was.
I think it was OVW, then there was HWA, and UPW were like the three, right, at that time.
Yeah. And UPW was where John Cena came from, Victoria. I think The Miz later came through there a little bit. So Rocky's really young at this time, 18, maybe 17 years old. And I was, I don't know, 15, 14 years old, something like that. And we would do like the training there, and we would do the TV tapings, the local TV tapings and stuff. They would give us matches. We weren't under contract or anything like that. But, you know, we were good enough to be, it was like being in NXT on scholarship. To put it into perspective, imagine if you watched NXT and you saw like a 15-year-old kid having a tag match with another 17-year-old kid, and that during the weekdays, they were also training in the PC with like Matt Riddle or like, you know, some of the stars or somebody that maybe came in to put in some work or whatever. But like, that's like what we were, which is wild enough. But New Japan came into play because at a certain point, the sister company relationship ended. But UPW wasn't like a common independent. It was run by Rick Bassman. He's very business minded. He's in sports management. And he thought immediately, well, we need to sister up with another company immediately. He wasn't just going to run a wrestling company. That's not what he does. So in comes 01, which was brand new at the time. And a bunch of the guys, I think some of the guys have went to All Japan from New Japan, I think. And then a handful of others broke off and formed 01. But 01 was not on terrible terms, I think, with New Japan. It was like kind of standoffish.
01 was supposed to be an angle that, so like Hashimoto left to start a company, and it was just supposed to be an angle. It wasn't supposed to be a real company. Like, they were going to run a couple of shows to act like they were like opposing New Japan, and they were going to come back and like fight each other. But then it was a work that turned into a shoot, and he ended up getting a financial person to back the whole thing. And they ended up starting a company and it kind of blew up. It's like Inoki's old school thinking. I mean, that's like Inoki. That's like he was the king of that shit.
Which that's the second part of is Inoki was sort of like the Inoki office was almost like a go-between New Japan, Zero One, and UPW. They were in between all of this. So when Zero One and Rick Bassman formed a relationship, that's when you started seeing Samoa Joe really blow up and go overseas. And like the legend of Joe became this thing. Because before Ring of Honor, before all that, people knew who Joe was. And that's where that is where he blew up, going from being this guy on UPW that was like, you should give this guy a contract. He's beating S.A. Rios' ass on Shotgun Saturday Night and shit. And they're like, who is this guy? He's great. And then he's going to Zero One and doing all this badass stuff with Otani and Hashimoto. So guys basically that were left without a deal from WWF at the time, they still weren't WWE yet, from that partnership ending, Rick Bassman funneled them into Zero One. But the Inoki office had plans to build the New Japan extension. So they kind of were around and sort of kind of in that space going, well, who else do you have left? So we were like the fucking misfits that we weren't even good enough to go to Zero One. And they're like, well, we got these guys that we're not going to fucking do anything with.
We thought for sure we were going to Zero One because that, you know, like WWE had all the big guys and all the shit. We're like, well, you know, we're the guys who can like do the style. We like, you know, we're always talking and about, you know, Jushin Liger and like, did you see this Liger fucking Eddie Guerrero match? Like we're like studying this shit night and day. So we thought we were shoo-ins for Zero One. And all they wanted were the guys who didn't go to WWE at that time, who didn't have WWF contracts. They took the next big guys, the bodybuilders.
It was only heavyweight. Like, they didn't take any juniors. Yeah,
they didn't want any small guys, you know, like even they weren't even like sure they were going to take Spanky, Brian Kendrick. And then Kendrick made over and he only got over because Hashimoto thought he looked like Leonardo DiCaprio. So then that's why,
he
fell in love with them.
That's why he was named Leonardo Spanky in Japan.
Leonardo Spanky. And he'd go on the corner and do the fucking Titanic pose and come out to Titanic. Yeah. Zero One became a wild ass fucking place.
That's how we ended up there. We were basically the bad batch, you know, we were the misfits, the little rascals. And so they were like, okay, well, these guys, they're good. That's basically like Rick Bassman and UPW's end of it. They're like, well, these guys are good, but we don't have anything for them. And so we became like X-Men first class. And then they found out like, yeah, we were really, really good. And then the rest is history from there.
Brian really writes in his book about like the experience in the LA dojo. And he referenced TJ. He referenced you like a bunch of times being like this young kid, this really talented wrestler, and Rocky too. Like, you know, he was talking about how in the West, they were really breeding amazing wrestlers that nobody was paying attention to at the time. And then once you guys go overseas, it just starts like this legendary run that you guys are still on today. It's insane to me. It's just utterly fucking crazy how everything really works and how everybody is so connected in so many ways.
I think Brian tells the story of us getting smacked in the face after the dome.
Yeah. He does. Yeah. Everybody lines up and y'all getting mollywopped. So, yo, okay. Rocky, did you get slapped too?
Of course.
Like, how do you just sit there and take it and not just like see red rats as somebody just openly just palms you in the face?
You have to remember, though, at the time, like, we were being pushed pretty hard. Like, I don't think I'm a tough guy ever, especially not now. But at the time, we were kind of like dogs being poked with a stick for a long time. So we were kind of like killers a little bit. So we were used to getting hit, or that wasn't surprising.
Basically, like, at the dojo every day, we were training, like, hard as fuck. But we were, like, training, like, basically, we were training for MMA fights, even though we were supposed to be doing pro wrestling. Because that was just the system. Like, Inoki wanted us to, like, know how to do, like, both, you know? And we're already, like, good at wrestling. So, like, even when we come and do, like, he'd be like, oh, get in the ring, show me what you guys have been working on. We do like matches and stuff. And he'd be like, great, but you need to do more fucking jujitsu.
Yeah. Like, all right. Well, like that was the reason for the LA gym was there was a culture struggle at the time in the company. Like I think New Japan, a lot of
it was between Pride and pure professional wrestling. Yeah, a lot of like that was
like a lot of New Japan saw the progressiveness of professional wrestling and they wanted to embrace that, which is you can see today, like it's still it's the pinnacle of what people think is like the top class of professional wrestling. But in a way, it's funny because they look like they looked at like Inoki, like your ideas are passe because he wanted to be like, we need to go back to the beginning, like Gotch style training when everybody could really fucking roll. Like Sayama could go, Fujinami could go, Fujiwara could go. All these guys knew how to really wrestle. He wanted that. And they looked at that as that's passe. But the thing is, they were both ahead of the curve. So like New Japan wanting to be more progressive, they were totally right because, you know, now you have this generation like over the last 10 years with like the Young Bucks and Kenny that have like evolved it to something you never would have thought in the late 90s that this is what wrestling would look like. And New Japan saw that. They wanted that. But Inoki also saw that like a lot of the shoot style will catch on because at the time MMA was like nobody cared that much about MMA.
No, but this was Pride. Pride was at its was about to go into its highest peak. So he was on the cusp of he knew that the future of combat sports in Japan was going to be MMA. So he wanted to bring New Japan to be like, to be able to rival that. So he wanted guys to do crossover fights. He wanted to bring shooters into New Japan. Like he wanted to have Crow Cop do pro wrestling. Like he was thinking in that route. And there was the rest of New Japan was thinking, we don't want that, you know, like, because we want to be different. We want to be like what TJ's saying, we want to progress in professional wrestling, you know, like more.
And I feel like both of those sides too looked at each other like, they both thought arc is going to go like this. And the other was like, no, it's going to go like this. And the funny thing is that it ended up both being true because wrestling did progress the way that New Japan, most of the company thought it would. And they rode that wave.
They separated though. That was the thing though, right?
But then, the progression of style that Inoki thought would come eventually became, now it's like all the rage. The guys are doing like, there's blood sport now. And like people are doing flying arm bars, octopus holds are like all the rage and stuff like that. And that was something that I think Inoki was way, way, way too early on, but he was not wrong. Like that ended up being something that's also accepted as progressive now, which is funny. What's old is new again.
He would tell us like, I want you to basically like represent me and like my, this style that I want to create where it's like very like MMA influenced. So like, that was what the dojo was all about. Like, so we weren't doing much wrestling training as we were doing more like MMA shit, like, and learning how to like fight basically. So then when we got booked into New Japan to do matches, it was like this Tokyo Dome show, right? And the Korakuen show before that. I mean, I don't know if you want to take it from here, but like, that's kind of like the setup for it.
I mean, eventually getting back to all of us getting smacked in the face. But like, I do remember when we first got there, because I told somebody this recently, like we were bred to be a certain way. And I don't think we were that way as wrestlers before that, but we had spent a year or two kind of being pushed a certain way. And we got there and a lot of the New Japan, the everyday New Japan boys were like, calm down, like fuck, dude, like you guys are a little too hard and a little bit too wild. But in our head we were like it was like we had to fight for our lives. But that's because every day we were getting our ass kicked by like the Shark Tank guys or like the Raw Center. Like, you know, we had to spar with like legit killers, so we were like a little bit scared to death in a lot of ways. But when we got smacked, that story, it wasn't shocking necessarily, but Brian didn't assimilate the same way that we did. And Brian also wasn't always there for some of the earlier stuff. And like when sometimes when it was super hard on us. But I just remember we're in the line and I think Reyes or Rocky gets smacked first and we all kind of stone faced it, but Brian goes, oh, he sells it like like it's almost like somebody
sold it so
it's
big.
Almost like somebody told him to sell it like that because it's a promo. Like it was I thought I was gonna get slapped twice for laughing at Brian, but I remember Brian telling that story in his book. But that was it was meant for motivation because we would get smacked. I mean, I was the young boy of the group, so I would get smacked for making mistakes, of course. But Inoki's way, it was a cultural thing with him that it was also an honor to get smacked, like if you did a good job. So there, it was basically like a motivation thing, like, hey, you guys kind of all had, like, it wasn't their first dome, it was my first dome, but we all kind of did this one together. And it was like, you guys are doing a good job and, you know, do better next time. So we got smacked. It wasn't punishment, it was just motivation, but that's what that story in the book was. And it, to most people, that would seem a little shock.
Well, did you feel that it was an honor to get smacked in the face?
I mean, he could have just said, I'm proud of you, you know?
Yeah, or he could have said, hey, that fucking sucked. Do better. I'm like, all right. Either way, I would feel the same way, you know, like.
Were the smacks getting harder each time, or did, like, Rocky, were you first and then Reyes got smacked? Or was it like, did you guys compare, remember, like, who got hit the hardest?
No, I think they're, because it wasn't like, there wasn't a lot of time. Like, the cadence was like. So, like, when I say Brian reacted, it was like Brian reacted and was also getting smacks while he was reacting. It was one of those,
as you're watching, you're like, what the fuck? Oh,
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, you can only get through what the fuck before you got it. Yeah.
Now, last week, Rocky tells an amazing story, right? About you inciting a riot between All Japan and New Japan, where it was just like this huge brawl because you were holding Nakanishi's merce.
So we all had about the same amount of experience generally in wrestling, but I was significantly younger than these guys. And not just that I was younger, but like at a delicate age too. Like I was 17 going on 18 and these guys were in their early 20s. Rocky was 19, but obviously we talked about he's a 40-year-old man at 16. So, but they were, in life, they were much more mature than me. So they looked at me like a project, like you're really good. You've been wrestling as long as these guys, but we could do, you know, the traditional thing with you. So it was kind of like, you know, like the Benoit thing. Like I was in the dojo and like sweeping, like if I had to go on tour, they would go and do the stuff they were booked for. But if I went, I had to go 3 weeks early.
And we'd be like, yeah, so they would, hotel, yeah, we, you know,
yeah, like, we would get off the dojo and it would be like this because I would have to go to the dojo and do, and, you know, cook the foods and sweep the floors and do that stuff and the training and all that. And at the time it was like way more old school. It's like, I had to like wash guys' backs in the shower and carry bags, like, you know, stuff that you hear about, like in like the 70s and 80s and junk. Right. And, I think like, in retrospect, I guess Nakanishi selected me as his like individual young boy. Cause he always would, without saying anything, he'd always hand me his bag and I had to follow him around. And we're in the middle of the tour in some small town and Nakanishi wants to go out. So I had to carry his merce while we hit up like hostess bars and stuff like that. And we would just go and he would drink and it was just us. Like I think he was just talking to total strangers in his bars. I don't know. I got bored one time and we were downstairs. I walked outside to the sidewalk and just like didn't feel like being in there anymore. So I went upstairs. There's a different bar upstairs and they had a bunch of the New Japan boys and some of the All Japan boys were hanging out together. Cause some of the All Japan boys, like we mentioned earlier, had left the company. They used to be New Japan boys. So I think Nagata was there. I think Kojima was there, Nishimura and Kendo Kashin. That was the first time I met Kendo Kashin, which is funny because I always loved him. And when I met him, he was cool as shit. And then later he hated me. I don't know what happened. I still think he's cool as shit. And he hates me. This dude. I think I love that he's a goofball. I love everything. But for whatever reason, he hated me and probably half of the human race for whatever reason. Went upstairs and they're like, what are you doing here by yourself? And why are you carrying a purse? And I said, oh, this is Nakanishi's. Like, why do you have Nakanishi's bag? And I said, oh, he's downstairs. I think Nishimura was like a little bit far gone at that point, was like, he's making you hold his stuff. And he, I think, kind of had a personal grudge with Nakanishi at the time anyway. And so did Kendo Kashin, dating back from when they were like amateur wrestlers. So these guys were like, oh, he can't be young boy and you like that. You're a foreigner. You should be taken care of. Like, fuck this. And so at least those two tried to get up and walk downstairs to fight him. And the guy was like, you can't, no, just let it go. And I remember thinking, oh God, I think I just split the company in half right now. This is bad. You know, because Nakanishi was up there and he's, you know, getting up to being a top guy. And these guys were established heavyweights. Nagata was a big star.
He probably won the belt, right? Probably not too long after that, I would say.
Yeah, because I think around that time he did the matches with Bob Sapp at the Dome and stuff like that. And I was like, I mean, it was the equivalent of accidentally starting a fight between Randy Orton, John Cena, and Roman Reigns. Like, it was like some of them were hanging out, and then they were like, oh, Roman's fucking around downstairs, let's kick his ass. And I was like, oh. And like, meanwhile, I'm like Kalisto, and I'm like, no, don't do that.
Holy shit.
Wow. Wow. You troublemaking son of a bitch.
That was a fucking trip down memory lane that I didn't want to take, but I enjoyed every fucking second of it. TJ, it's a fucking pleasure to have you on here. If you want to plug your Twitter, your Instagram, wherever people can find you.
Yeah, I'm pretty simple. You can find me on pretty much any platform at MegaTGP. I don't have like a Facebook or a lot of the fancy stuff like TikTok or whatever. I got an Instagram and now it's mostly baby pictures. So
where can they find the merch?
Yeah, you can find me. I have a Pro Wrestling Tees store. You can find it under the TJP tab under there. Collar and Elbow put up a new shirt for me too. Mama Splash shirt. So you go check that out. If you use the code MEGATJP, you, I don't know, get a free wish or something. I don't know what happens. Something happens.
And then this weekend, September 25th and 26th, you were a part of the New Japan Strong Tour in Dallas, Texas. Are you excited about that?
Hell yeah. Night one, I get to join a bunch of good brothers, myself, Leo Rush, Juice Robinson, and my beloved partner, Clark Connors. And we're taking on all 73 members of the Bullet Club, or at least says the flyer, just says Bullet Club. So who knows? Who knows gonna be there? It might be Team 2000. I don't know. And then second day, I get to kick the crap out of another Young Lion. So we'll see. Last time I had this opportunity was Ren Narita, and he found out the hard way to not test my gangsters. So,
it's getting spicy.
Yeah, Uemura dropped a few for me in the junior tag league, so he probably wants that back. I might lose that, to be honest. He's probably mad.
Thank you, everybody, for a wonderful week. Check out the Patreon. If you want to check out more Talking Shop, check out our YouTube page. There's a bunch of great content up on there. And we will see y'all next week. Hopefully the good brothers will be back with us in the shop. If not, it's me and Emilio, and I can talk as much as I fucking want because the good brothers are not here. See you next week.